Hello and welcome to WRI's Big Ideas into Action podcast. Today we're looking at carbon dioxide removal. It clearly has an important role to play in mitigation, but what are the big questions that first need to be answered?
There's a responsibility to really think through the equity considerations from the very start.
How do we make sure that the countries that want to do it can do it? How do we make sure it generates economic opportunity?
We'll hear from the authors of a new WRI paper that explores the potential of CDR and what we need to think about first, from governance and technology transfer to how it needs to be balanced with emissions reductions. Hello, this is the World Resources Institute's Big Ideas into Action podcast. I'm Nicholas Walton, and the idea we're looking at today is carbon dioxide removal. We recently published a working paper on the subject, which notes that although more and more countries are seeing it as part of their commitments to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, there remain many questions about how this can happen. I spoke to the working paper's authors to ask about those questions and whether they had any answers. The authors are Katie Lebling, Daniel Riedel, and Clear Schumer. Clear first, where exactly does CDR fit in?
To achieve the more ambitious end of the Paris Agreement goal and limit warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, recent scientific consensus has indicated the necessity of reaching what we call net zero carbon dioxide emissions by around mid-century. So the question emerges, what is net zero and what does it actually mean? Net zero is achieved when all emissions that are released by human activities in a year are counterbalanced by an equivalent amount of carbon dioxide removal, which brings the sum total of emissions and removals to zero. So I like to think about it like a simple equation. The pluses are any residual or remaining amount of emissions that we are still generating at the point at which we've agreed to reach net zero by. And the idea is that we will still need to compensate for these emissions, these pluses, with an equivalent amount of minuses or carbon removal that directly pulls the residual emissions from the atmosphere to get us to that end state of net zero. So while we know that rapid and deep emissions reductions are first and foremost needed for reaching net zero emissions, and again, that's making the plus side of the equation as small as we possibly can, projections from the IPCC, the world's foremost climate science body, demonstrate that we will likely still need to remove billions of metric tons of carbon dioxide annually by 2050 to keep climate goals within reach. So that's where this carbon removal piece really comes in.
Katie, turning to you, the general background on carbon dioxide removal, what are the different options available to us as we look to put a few minuses into the equation, as Claire said?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different options out there that are approaches or practices or actual technologies. All of these are ways to actively pull CO2 out of the atmosphere. So CO2 that's already in the atmosphere from past emissions is building up. That's what we need to pull out to address the residual emissions Cleo was talking about. Within the term carbon dioxide removal or just carbon removal, there's kind of a range that people often talk about between natural approaches as well as technological or engineered approaches, sometimes industrial approaches. And so on the natural end, you can think of things like trees. We don't really have to do anything except plant more trees to help that happen. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's more technological approaches, things like direct air capture. That's one technology that's gotten a lot of attention and investment recently. Some people talk about it like a vacuum cleaner for the atmosphere, but it's a big machine, kind of like if you envision like an industrial facility, and it uses specific types of chemicals that selectively react with CO2. So in that way, it pulls the CO2 out of the air, then you can apply some heat that will release the CO2, and then you have to do something with it, inject it into the ground, ideally for permanent storage. There are other types of, I guess, more engineered approaches, like carbon mineralization and enhanced rock weathering. So that is a little different in that you can spread kind of crushed up rock on agricultural fields, or you can also do it in the ocean. And that rock will react and capture CO2 and sequester it in the form of solid carbonates. In this analysis that we're going to talk about later on, our scope has mainly been on these more technological or newer approaches, basically approaches that are not providing large-scale carbon removal today. All of these more technological options that we focus on are pretty early stage and expensive, but we know that they'll be needed alongside these more natural approaches like tree restoration.
So, Clear, they're early stage, they're expensive. Which kinds of countries? Are there any countries specifically interested in these? Has anyone put themselves forward?
So to contribute their part to achieving this global net zero target, the last 5 or so years have seen dozens and dozens of countries and subnational regions and thousands of companies committing to reaching net zero emissions of their own. When a company or a country or a subnational government commits to net zero, what it effectively is committing to is balancing any remaining emissions that it is still producing at its net zero target date with an equivalent amount of carbon removal, whether that carbon removal is through natural approaches like forest restoration that Katie was mentioning, or this more technological kind of nascent type of carbon removal that we explore more in our paper, like direct air capture. In the last 5 years, more than 90 countries, including the world's largest emitters and the world's least developed nations, have committed to national net zero emissions by mid-century. Details vary drastically, not just in carbon removal, but also in the conventional kind of emissions reduction approaches that will be used.
From what we've seen in our analysis, which I think at the point that we did the analysis, there were about 62 countries that had submitted long-term strategies, and I think about 26 of them had either included some sort of plans to rely on technological CDR or mentioned that they were considering relying on it. So that's a pretty good portion, not quite half, but a significant portion. So that kind of got us thinking, like, it's really interesting that this is happening. And it's also happening without much guidance from the UNFCCC or from anyone else around how countries can and should be thinking about this. How much should they think about CDR in relation to emissions reductions? Is there some kind of percentage target that they should be aiming for emissions reductions versus CDR? But yeah, this kind of got us thinking about what are the governance gaps at the international level that could help provide more guidance for countries around how to think about how CDR should fit into their long-term climate plans. And the main areas that we looked at are around mitigation deterrence. So the idea that using CDR could deter the urgency of emissions reductions in the near term. We also thought about equity, kind of in the responsibility of who should be paying for CDR and who should be benefiting from it. And then also measurement, reporting, and verification. So the like actual counting and reporting and verifying, did these removals happen? How much? Where? Are they still happening over time?
Well, let's tackle those three one by one. So Katie, just staying with you, the concern that there's this real risk of moral hazard about mitigation deterrence, could you fill in exactly how that would work and what the governance gap is that you've identified, or several if there are more than one, and what are you recommending?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of a key question, and sometimes some cases a criticism that comes up about carbon removal writ large is that it is essentially saying that there's these technologies and approaches out there that can pull CO2 out of the air for us. So I think some people can take that as meaning, oh, so we don't need to do as much to reduce emissions today if later on we can just pull them out of the air.
Yeah, waiting for the technology, really.
Exactly, yeah. So it's kind of this reliance on a future technology to save us rather than maybe doing the work now to not have to rely on that future technology. But I think the main issue here is that we don't want to over-rely on CDR in meeting these targets. We have very little CDR today, but we think this is important because countries are planning what they need to do out to 2050. And so if they're making plans for relying on a large amount of carbon removal, that will inform the policy development in their country and potentially result in that high level of CDR. So I think this is an issue today in the sense that these plans are long-term and they send those policy signals. And so we think this type of over-reliance on CDR could be a concern in that, as I said, it could take the urgency off of emissions reduction approaches, which are needed in the near term to peak emissions as soon as possible. And in most cases, like 85%, 90%, 95% of mitigation on the way to net zero should be emissions reduction. And this is for several reasons. Emissions reduction is generally cheaper today than carbon removal. It provides a lot of co-benefits that can improve health, development, gender equality, lots of other things. And it also has that time component. It's a lot easier to reduce emissions now than it is to 5, 10, 15 years from now, figure out a way to pull CO2 out of the air.
Can you explain a bit about the hard to abate emissions? What exactly do you mean by that?
There is no consensus definition of what counts as hard to abate. There's political definitions, there's technological definitions. Sometimes it's called residual emissions when you're at net zero. It's basically what's left over that you can't get at with existing technologies to reduce emissions. So, for example, non-CO2 emissions in agriculture, like rice paddies, produce GHG emissions. It's very hard to abate those. And we don't have the technologies today. So that might qualify as something that we can offset with carbon removal. There are other examples like long-haul shipping and aviation. It's hard to reduce those emissions. Other sectors, I think heavy industry sometimes gets pulled in, that we do have some emerging ways to deal with those. And so the important thing is also this definition will change over time. As technology develops, we'll be able to reduce more emissions, and what counts as residual emissions will probably decline over time. The kind of recommendations that we have to help address this, to start addressing this, are a pretty basic one that we have put forward before, others have mentioned, which is just setting separate targets for emissions reduction and carbon removal. So this creates transparency around how much you're planning to reduce versus how much you're planning to use carbon removal to get at the last residual or hard to abate emissions. This has been done at the state level in the US. California set a law to reduce emissions by 85%. I think New York and Washington State have similar laws. And in the private sector context, science-based targets has provided guidance that companies should be reducing emissions 90 to 95% using CDR for 5 to 10% of what's left over. We think it's also important to, as part of that, kind of create transparency around, along with those expected gross emissions reductions, how much carbon removal is expected to come from natural approaches like land sink enhancement, so like tree restoration, soil carbon, et cetera. And then what is really left over to be dealt with technological carbon removal.
So turning to you, Danielle, what's the equity angle for this? Because as we've just been discussing, the technologies that we're talking about, they're off in the future. They sound expensive. They sound complicated. It sounds like something that richer countries are better positioned to be able to take advantage of. What's the equity angle as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there's so many different considerations here. So one big challenge is who should be paying for carbon removal? And the other big challenge is how do we make sure that the communities that host these projects can benefit from them and are not harmed by some of the uncertainties that are still surrounding many technologies? So in terms of who pays for them at the international level, in our paper, we discussed that governance really need to play a key role in supporting the development and the deployment of carbon removal, especially when we think of carbon removal as a public good. There's a strong case to be made for the responsibility of developed countries to pay for CDR. So developed countries have historically been the biggest emitters. They've contributed the most to our current state of the climate crisis. Countries in the global north, that where the development of carbon removal technologies is also primarily concentrated at the moment, really have a responsibility to help develop them, to help pay for them, to reduce the costs overall, and to de-risk them so that we can make sure that these technologies are safe to use in other contexts as well.
So some form of technology transfer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the solutions. But I think there's some considerations here because there is growing interest from developing countries to develop carbon removal projects. So there's a good example in Kenya, and there's actually being one developed right now. It's the first DAC plant in the African continent, but also the first DAC plant in the global south. And, you know, proponents of DAC in Kenya point to several conditions that would make Kenya a good place for direct air capture. It has vast geothermal energy resources, which is a renewable energy resource that can power DAC. And also investments into DAC in Kenya could help scale up the supply of geothermal energy for people there. It could also help drive job creation. And there's also sufficient basalt for rock formations where the CO2 that's been removed can then be stored safely and permanently. But then I think this raises questions about You know, we just said that we think that developed countries that have contributed to the climate crisis should really be the ones that are responsible for cleaning that up and for helping build that up. So there's this argument or there's conversation to be had about should Kenya really be engaging in CDR when they've done so little to contribute to the climate crisis? But then at the same time, there's obviously an economic opportunity here. And then that's where technology transfer comes in. If countries like Kenya decide that this is something that they would like to do, then it's the responsibility of countries like the United States, where this technology is being developed, to help ensure that it's being done safely and well in other places.
Does that then imply that there's some kind of market could be created in CDR, where a country like Kenya developing technologies that are particularly suitable to its own situation, that they can actually create a whole new sector, a whole new economic sector, and bring in money from outside?
Yeah, precisely. I think one of the big arguments for the creation of DAC in Kenya is that it could help employ lots of young professionals that are seeking job creations, but also that it could help bring in investment into Kenya and drive up this, I guess, DAC sector there. But yeah, I think sort of the selling and the buying of carbon credits could become relevant here, but the international processes that would govern this are still being worked out. While these are still being worked out, I think we need to sort of tackle questions about how technology transfer could happen in the meantime.
Article 6 of the Paris Agreement allows countries to use, quote, cooperative approaches to meet their climate targets. So this includes bilateral trading of credits, this marketplace for buying and selling of credits. So let's say Kenya does build this massive direct air capture capacity, and they are able, they set themselves up to remove tons of carbon from the atmosphere, more so perhaps even than they would need to, let's say, reach their own net zero target. They could consider going to the marketplace and selling those carbon removal credits to an interested buyer who might not have the capacity to build up that carbon removal on their own. But if they are able to purchase it from a willing seller, they could then count that toward their net zero target. But this all is a really, really tricky accounting problem, and some serious rules are being devised to kind of govern it, because of course you can imagine there is a whole mess of issues with counting, making sure that these credits aren't being double counted, making sure that a removal that expected to happen is actually happening.
And I actually just wanted to go back to one point on the equity conversation. I think we can also, like, technology transfer, I think, is great. And really, there is a role, like Danielle said, for developed countries to be de-risking these technologies, bringing down the cost, making them more accessible for everyone who wants to use them. But I think there's also, these technologies could also be developed in global South countries themselves. And so how do we empower them to do that? How do we, like, create more opportunities for multilateral communication and collaboration at the international level, so countries can talk to each other about how they're thinking about these technologies, what they're planning to do, lessons learned, creating opportunities for co-development or cooperative, like, research opportunities across countries to bring more people together to talk about this.
When we talk about the transfer of technology, what we think of is, you know, transferring a solar panel, for example, to one context to another. But it's important to point out that it's not just the transfer of an actual DAC plant or sort of the intellectual property rights of a technology. The way that a DAC plant, for example, is developed and set up, for example, in California or in Texas, is going to be very different to the way that a DAC plant is set up in Kenya. There's going to be different energy sources. There's a different climate. So we cannot just take a technology from one place and compare it apples to apples or implement it in the exact same way in another context. And to add to that, technology transfer is already being done in many other different settings. And this is really an opportunity for different countries to cooperate and to help facilitate access to information and to technical assistance and to help boost other countries' local innovation systems.
Now, moving on to the measurement, reporting, and verification, why exactly is this so important? It sounds pretty foundational.
Yeah, it is foundational. So Measurement, reporting, verification, MRV for short, measurement of just actually measuring the carbon that is carbon dioxide or carbon that's been reduced or removed, reporting it transparently and publicly to third-party platforms, and then verification by third parties as well to ensure that the measurement is correct and actually happened. And then there's also a second M, monitoring, that is sometimes thrown in there, MMRV, and that's ongoing monitoring of the removal or the reduction to ensure that it is continuing to happen over time and it hasn't been reversed. So basically, it's a system to ensure that what has been said to happen actually did happen and is continuing to happen over time. So it's a mechanism of transparency and building of public trust, I think. You've seen issues around MRV related to the voluntary market more broadly, and probably in the news, like articles around how emissions reduction and avoidance credits are actually not all they said they were, and some of them are not as high quality as was hoped. And carbon removal is kind of the newer entrant into this voluntary carbon market, where most of the credits are around reduction or avoidance. So carbon removal makes up about 3% of what's bought and sold on the voluntary market. And so it's coming in and having to kind of deal with these legacy issues, some of which are not as relevant to CDR. A lot of questions with the existing voluntary market credit quality are around additionality. Is this actually an additional reduction? And so that is kind of, I think, easier to figure out in most cases with carbon removal, because you build DAC plant and it is inherently additional. But there are other questions around removals that I think come up in the context of MRV. A lot of these approaches are newer, as I said. So the technologies, the approaches are being developed at the same time that the way to measure their removal is being developed. And in some cases, that measurement is very difficult. So for example, if you're spreading alkaline feedstocks on a crop field, it's very hard to measure, like put enough sensors all over the field to understand where is the removal happening? How fast is it happening? So the measurability is difficult. And at the same time, companies working on carbon removal are starting to develop their own measurement, reporting and verification standards. And so they're kind of doing this on their own. There isn't really an overarching regulatory body that's telling them how to do this and what standards they need to adhere to. At the same time, most technological carbon removal approaches are also not included in the guidance that countries use to count up their own emissions, national inventory guidance. So if countries are trying to figure out how far are we on the way to achieving our NDC targets, counting CDR in that is often, it's not really in the guidance today. So there's a lot of questions around how that will work. I think there are some things that are moving toward improving the situation. So you'll see entities like the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market, ICVCM, is providing integrity certification on the supply side. Are credits high quality or not? And then on the demand side, how countries are claiming to use these credits, VCMI, is providing certification of how they can be claimed. And so there is movement there, and you'll see the EU has put forward their carbon removal certification framework, which is the first public sector voluntary framework for what counts as high quality carbon removal. And then at the same time that all of this is happening, as Clea was talking about, Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, negotiations around that are ongoing. So Article 6, which allows countries to use cooperative approaches to meet their climate targets, so bilateral trading of carbon credits, general cooperation through other means, and then Article 6.4, which creates this international marketplace for buying and selling of credits. Our thoughts in the space are, a lot of this is evolving as we go, so we're certainly tracking that. But I think one key piece is along the lines of how we have separate targets, or how we're advocating for separate targets for emissions reductions and carbon removal. It's important to also make it clear that certain credits are removal and certain credits are emissions reduction. So differentiating the type of credits that you're talking about. But yeah, creating more transparency around what actually is underneath these targets. When you say a ton of carbon, is it a ton reduced, a ton removed? Is it a ton removed through biomass and biological processes, or is it a ton removed through direct air capture and geologic sequestration? Because those have different levels of durability and permanence and should be counted differently, I think, in inventories and how they're considered by buyers.
So, Katie, what do you hope this paper will do to kind of achieve a foundation for the governance in this space?
Yeah, so we see this paper as really exploratory for us. It's kind of our first step into the international space and how CDR shows up there. And so we are hoping it just really generates more conversation. We want to talk to more people about what they think of these recommendations, whether they seem feasible, whether they should be refined, and then hopefully bring them forward to people that can actually make those changes.
Clea?
We need to provide more clarity around what reaching net zero emissions will actually entail. Everyone talks about their net zero targets and everyone says they've got a target, but what does it actually mean and how do we actually do it? And how do we actually put the long-term target in good stead today? And I think that is going to require a frank acknowledgement of the fact that carbon removal will likely play a role in achieving many of these net zero targets. And as such, we need to have serious conversations at the international level about how this really tricky, nascent technology will be governed. How do we make sure it's done in a way that counts? How do we make sure it's done in a way that is fair? How do we make sure it is financed? How do we make sure that the countries that want to do it can do it? How do we make sure it generates economic opportunity? How do we make sure that it is not placed in places where countries and communities do not want it? These are all important questions. And I think that the first step is, of course, acknowledging them and then beginning to inject guidance into formal international processes, whether those are from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which has set a lot of rules around emissions reductions, but not so much on carbon removal, whether that is through the IPCC and the IPCC issuing formal guidance to countries about how to do this and how to make sure that you're doing it well and responsibly. That is my main goal in kind of starting to raise these governance challenges.
And Danielle?
I really want to emphasize the importance of doing CDR well. You know, this entire sector, it's an emerging sector. It's surrounded by many uncertainties still, but there's truly an opportunity. And, you know, I would also say there's a responsibility to really think through the equity considerations from the very start. So at the international level, as we already talked about, it's about who should pay, how can we make sure that climate technologies, that there's equitable access to them, and also how to make sure that the communities that host these projects are not negatively impacted, that they have a say in how the project pans out from the start. We really need to establish avenues for greater international dialogue so that we can tackle these difficult questions.
And that was Danielle Riedel. You also heard Katie Lebling and Clea Schumer. They're the authors of a new WRI working paper titled International Governance of Technological Carbon Removal, Surfacing Questions, Exploring Solutions. You'll also find an article on these issues on the Insights part of our website, wri.org. If you go to wri.org/podcasts, you'll obviously find much, much more. But for now, goodbye.